Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 155 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. That's a lot of episodes. I've not missed a week in almost 3 years. And some weeks there's been two, three or four episodes. So that's pretty cool. And it's amazing that you all continue coming along and listening. We've had over 9 million downloads. And we're pushing on towards 10 million, which is crazy. So thank you all for tuning in. I hope you all enjoyed last week's episode with Neil Fitzmaurice. It kind of links to this week's episode because this is two different people that I'm working with on Walk Like a Panther. Now, when I recorded this, we were still on an embargo, I guess. We weren't allowed to talk about the project yet. Since recording it, it's been announced, so we can. It was amazing to sit down and talk to Chris. I mean, on the podcast, but equally, it's been amazing to talk to him every day on set and just have... He's just an amazing storyteller. He's got amazing experiences and is, I mean, quite clearly an amazing actor. So, hope you enjoy this one. Before we get to it, summer is definitely here. It keeps coming and going. It's fighting itself a bit, but... SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com, we have our Dark Summer range out now where you can get Scroobius Pip swimsuits for the ladies, swim shorts for the gentlemen, sunglasses, leggings, vests, everything. There's loads of good stuff there. There's tons of other stuff on the website too. There's Distraction Pieces specific stuff. There's two different Distraction Pieces t-shirts that you can get. There's a Distraction Pieces mug. There's Drunk Cast t-shirts. There's a few of them left, so grab them. There's CDs, there's vinyl, there's DVDs, there's digital downloads, there's everything you could possibly want. So head over to SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com and help yourselves to all of that good stuff. Anything else I need to plug or mention? I don't think so. When this comes out, so this will come out the week after. I've not told anyone about this, but I'm doing a charity thing with Samuel L. Jackson. And while I was on set filming Walk Like a Panther, I just got an email out of the blue from Samuel L. Jackson just saying, "Hey man, sorry to email out of the blue. It's Samuel L. Jackson here," which is a mind-blowing thing to get. So, I'll tell you all about that probably in next week's episode because it will have happened then. It's not happened yet in this one. For me, it's happening next week, but for you, it happened last week. Confusing, right? Yeah, I know. Anyway, let's get on with this. Episode 155. It's a two-parter. Part one is up now, and part two will be out at midday. So part one, I just talked to Chris. We talk a bit about Taboo, the project that me and him worked on with Stephen Graham, with Tom Hardy, and with all these amazing people. We talk a little bit vaguely about Walk Like a Panther. And then we really jump into his upbringing, and it's fascinating. I thought the upbringing part would be a 10-minute chat, and it turned into... a part one of the podcast. And then in part two, as set out at midday, he's very candid and open about working on our Vida Zane Pet, on the first Batman movie with Tim Burton and Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson and all these amazing people. He's really, he doesn't pull any punches on when he's happy and when he's not happy with stuff. So you get some real stories there. And then Alien 3, which again, he's got some mind-blowing stories of medical woe, of injuries, and all sorts of stuff. So check that out at midday, and I'll talk to you at the end. So enjoy. This is Christopher Fairbank on the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. And we're going. I'm here with Mr. Christopher Fairbank. How are you, sir?
I'm pretty good, thanks, Pip. Yeah.
That was a very formal introduction, I thought. I thought I'd go formal on this one.
Well, that's very kind of you. Most people don't.
Yeah, exactly. It's always awkward doing a podcast with anyone you're working on a project with, because in general, there's all sorts of embargoes on talking about that project in any way, shape or form.
Absolutely.
So we're working on something and it's been a really nice, and we've had some nice chats on set, and I thought it'd be great to get that on the record as such. So
why not?
I thought we'd have a chat.
normally with these, I'll kind of start with a bit of your growing up and backstory, and then you're working into your chosen industry and things like that. But I'm kind of going to go all over the place with this one, because I wanted to start with, because it's so fresh to me. I was saying the other day, in fact, we were in the car about to go to set, and I got a phone call to say I wasn't needed that day. Obviously. And there's been a film I've been trying to see for ages. So I got cancelled, and a lot of people, if you cancel that short notice, will be annoyed. I looked at my phone instantly and saw the film I wanted to see was on in half an hour, and it was a 10-minute walk away. So I was like, perfect, this is amazing. So I rushed over there. I sat down. I got my ice cream. I got my drink. I was loving it. I sat down, and it took me 10 minutes to be drawn into it, because I was thrown by the fact I didn't know you were in it as one of the main people. So I was just like, oh, we were just talking. This is, you know, it took me off. But it was
a little too close for comfort. The two worlds colliding.
Yeah, exactly. So it was Lady Macbeth, and it blew me away. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely.
How was that? It's rare to, and it kind of ties to where we first met on Taboo, because that is a kind of rare, reasonably low budget period piece. In general, period pieces are the high budget, lavish things, and Lady Macbeth had the feel of an indie film despite it being a period piece. So how was that to work on and to jump in on?
It was amazing. It was like so much of the third act, shall we say, of my career. I'm 63 and nearly three quarters now. So I'm well into the third act. It seems to be, shall we say, subtitled surreal.
Right.
And Lady Macbeth was an absolute case in point. I'd had an extraordinary year that year, and we're, 2017 now? So I think it would have been 2015, the end of, and I was just on a roll, really, and this was yet another job that was what they call a straight offer, as opposed to having to go through the torture of casting and waiting and willing and all the other things that we go through in that sort of normal process.
This gig we're on now is the first one I've had that's been a straight offer. I wasn't aware that was a thing, particularly. I'm so new to this. I was like, everything I'd done before, I'd auditioned and cast and waited and not heard and then heard and not heard, and then the character got cut and all sorts of things like that. So this was the first one where they were like, we want you. And I was like, oh, okay, that's lovely. Kind of thank you. So that was one of
now, them. I wish people could see the expression, because that's exactly how I always feel. On the rare occasion that that straight offers come through, half of me is hugely relieved that you don't have to go through the nightmare that auditioning usually is. But the other half of me is a little nervous, to say the very least, because I am of the old school. Professionally speaking, and when I do get a straight offer, I immediately think, are they sure?
Have they got the right person?
Exactly, you know, they haven't seen me do it. And what happens on day one, take one, jaws hit the floor in, despair, really.
100%. I had exactly that on this project, because it was the same thing where I'm like, this is lovely, but again, in an audition, as tiring as they can be, or nerve wracking as they can be, you get to show them your interpretation of the character or the direction that you're thinking, even to the extent of the accent, which was the thing I was nervous about on this, because I was like, well, it's set up north. They've not told me I need to do an accent. They've cast. So do I just turn up and talk as me, or do I? So it was a nerve wracking one in that way, when it's like, they're trusting you to interpret it in your own way and just turn up and do it, rather than here's what I'm thinking.
That's right. Absolutely.
You know, so that's a scary one.
Well, to make it even more clenchy, yeah. There was a wonderful little postscript on the script and covering letter from William Oldroyd, who directed Lady Macbeth, you know, saying, well, very, very nice things.
Yeah, amazing.
Like my work, would love to work with me. He did talk about the character that I played in that movie as being the anchor in terms of weight. You know, dramatically speaking, that is,
because
I'm about 10 stone dripping wet. So it wasn't so much a physical reference, but it was indeed, you know, a dynamic that the movie most definitely required from that character.
100%. And I can also see how, I mean, you're speaking of being in the third act of your career. It must have been a huge appeal on that project for them, because so many people are very much in their first act of their career on that piece, and amazingly so. But that, I mean, I'm talking to you about it on set, because again, I came in the next day and I was like, it was amazing. I loved it. So I wanted to know about it. I wanted to learn about it, and learning that it was the director's first.
First
feature. Yeah. It was both of the leads. First features, really.
Florence Pugh had made one movie before, The Fall. Or The Falling.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. The Falling.
Yeah.
Cosmo Jarvis, the other lead actor, I'm not sure that he had indeed had any.
From a music.
That's right. His background is most definitely music.
Yeah.
So I think it was pretty close to his first.
Yeah. And both of those, though, were so, as soon as they were on screen, just drew you in so much. And Florence, in the lead in particular, it was just
stunning.
Amazing performance. Absolutely amazing. Exciting to see what's ahead there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the DOP, who obviously had camera experience as an operator. But this was her, Ari Wagner, her name is, and she, it was her first time out, totally in charge, so to speak.
Amazing.
And the photography is just incredible.
So, again, it's mad that the things that jump out are the photography, are the choices in direction and that lead role in particular. So it's amazing that some of those key bits that jump out are people having their first try
indeed.
It, but the beauty is the base that was given by, from what we spoke of, by the rest of the crew, by the rest of the cast, allowed those people that were doing it for the first time to have that freedom to try their ideas out, to try things out that you might not have tried if it's your 10th film and you've got your learnt bad habits as such, or your learnt your go-tos. It kind of allowed that freedom, it felt.
Yeah. Indeed. And the honesty that William had right from the get-go by telling everybody that this was his first feature.
Yeah.
He'd got to balance off the inexperience, if that is the right word.
Yeah.
It feels somehow harsh. But you know what I mean. He had the most fantastic assistant director team from first right through to third. There was a wealth of experience just to steady the ship, so to speak.
And I love that, like, from what you've said when we were discussing it, there wasn't any of that fake it until you make it type thing. There was very much an honesty of, look, this is the first time I've done this. I need all of you guys. All of you guys are important. And the beauty of that, I feel, is it also stops anyone who's got more experience but isn't directing. It stops them from having any, I'm going to take this in my direction, or I'm going to take over, or I'm going to do how I want to do it because I've got the experience. It instead says, look, I need you.
Yeah.
You know, I need you to guide me here, rather than,
absolutely,
brings them on side.
Absolutely. Well, that indeed can so often, sadly, be the case. That, you know, certain departments, you know, sniff inexperience and see this as an opportunity to to be kind, to step in and save the show, as they say.
Yeah.
When no saving is necessary, if we just work as a team,
and we
do what we're being hired to do.
Yeah.
The glue is without doubt, certainly in Lady Macbeth's case, is the script.
Yeah.
Which is a fantastic piece of work by Alice Birch, who adapted it from the original novella.
Yeah.
That,
because it was a novella, and then it got opera, a lot of name, and it got a lot of praise as an opera.
Yes.
It seemed like, and my brother was a big fan of the novella and the opera, and he just saw a poster for the first time in London for it and was like, wow, that's a really odd choice for a conversion and a bold choice for a conversion. Yeah. So he was kind of, he's the one that recommended it to me. It was like, you need to check this out.
It's
an exciting one.
Well, I've said this for many a year, but never more so does there be a case for it, insofar as nobody in my experience has ever set out to make a bad movie.
Yeah, of course.
Everybody tries their absolute best to make the best movie possible. What will always be a question, because there is actually no answer, is why is it that with all of that effort, with all of that positive vibe, if you will, towards every project, certainly that I've been involved in, why is it some don't really take off, some indeed tank, and others, for no real apparent reason, given that all the ingredients are the same, take off and somehow strike a chord with an audience more so than others. It's the thing, I guess, that keeps you coming back for more, really.
Yeah, it is a mystery. And the thing recently, a recent Fast and the Furious film is the biggest opening week box office of all time. And I'm not against the Fast and the Furious films. I'm not particularly a fan of them.
No, I don't think I've seen
again,
one
not,
of them. But
I'm not a movie snob in that way that I'd turn my nose at them as such. But it does make me go, why is that the biggest a box office? Like things like Star Wars, I could see why something like that would be, or even when Avatar came out and it was all the excitement of the new technology and all this kind of thing. It's like, again, not particularly films that are in my top 10 films of all time, but I understand that.
Yes, absolutely.
But it does make your mind a boggle a little bit of what was it that made that formula just come together and work for the public as such?
Well, I guess the thing is that it is an unanswerable, unquantifiable situation. Otherwise, it would be formularized, bottled, and every single movie would be a blistering success.
It'd be easy, wouldn't it?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And that's also another key factor, I think, in any project is when things seem to be a bit too easy, when everybody is slapping each other on the back and high-fiving and hugging and how aren't we wonderful, I start to get a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
Because there has to be that difficulty.
Yeah.
There has to be some sort of conflict. I don't mean, bust-ups and hissy fits and all the rest of it, although it is part and parcel of the thing, because you are working in a sort of heightened, unreal, dreamed-up reality.
Yeah.
And sometimes dreams clash, to put it
100%
one way, but it's all grist to the mill. It's all part and parcel of the process.
Yeah.
And for me, somehow, a little bit of of conflict, things going slightly wrong, Plan B's having to be hashed together a bit fast, and let's see if we can get round the obstacle this way. Those kind of problems that always engender some sort of conflict,
100%.
I find make the whole thing real, and I feel much more rooted in what I'm doing when it is like that. Lady Macbeth, it was cold. Oh, that house was cold, man.
Yeah,
you know, and because it was so low budget, there were no facilities.
Yeah.
There weren't dressing rooms. There was one room that we were allocated for wardrobe and makeup.
Right.
Gilding the lily there, in a sense. There was a makeup room, but there was, it was just one room. For both situations. There were no dressing rooms. There was a curtain that you could sort of discreetly change behind. There was nowhere to sit, and that is really difficult, because so much of, well, any actor's input in any given day's filming involves an awful lot of hanging around.
Yeah,
because unless you are in every single scene, there is going to be quite a lot of time where, A, you're not wanted, and B, you're not needed, and B, you are most definitely not wanted lurking around, getting in people's way.
100%.
And all the rest of it.
It's what... being so new to this industry, it's what I love is I found the areas of monitors or of wherever else where I can be making the most of my time waiting around. I can be learning, or I can be talking to guys who have been doing this a long time and things like that, and learning and being experienced without being that. I know on the first thing I did a few times, I really wanted to be kind of watching as it was being filmed. And things like that. And again, you learn quite quickly that there's a lot going on there. We need you out the way. But again, if you can get off to Monitor World or anywhere else, then that's kind of somewhere where you can be watching and learning and taking it in and not causing any grief. It's an interesting one because I completely agree with what you say there. If everyone making it is having too much fun, then it feels like in a lot of instances that's not going to translate on the screen. It seems like fun at the time, but it will feel that might not come across. Now, weirdly, again, being vague and mysterious, the project we're working on at the moment, the main drive of the story is a unity and everyone pulling together. So it feels on this project, the fact that everyone seems to get on really well, that feels like that will translate in this project. It's not the kind of project where that's an issue, but they're rare. Yeah. I think if in 90% a Taboo, for example, Taboo was one where there was a lot of people are working hard and having to make Plan B's and all that. If everyone had been there every day laughing and messing about, that wouldn't have translated in that type of show, because it's very bleak and very dark and very serious. Yeah. So that wouldn't have worked there.
Entirely different, wasn't it?
Yeah,
for sure.
And again, he had a lot on his shoulders. He had a job to do. So it pulls all that together in that way. Yeah. Let's kind of, again, there's often I'll work through someone's career. Your career's had too much in it for me to work through all of it, I'm afraid. I do apologise. But I've made some notes of ones I will get to. But let's go right back ahead of career. And you're an Essex boy at
indeed.
At heart. So, so where did you grow up, and what was your kind of upbringing like at that time?
Well, I grew up in an Essex village called Clavering, which now has a bit of the ring of fame attached to it.
Really?
Nothing to do with me, I hasten to add. But Jamie Oliver's family moved into Clavering. I can't remember exactly when, but it was a good few years ago.
Yeah.
They were certainly, as the local villagers thought, on a hiding to nothing in trying to revive the fortunes of... there were three pubs and probably still are, although yeah. I don't know, with pubs closing left, right and centre yeah, these days. Sure. But there used to be three pubs in Clavering, one of which was a pub called The Cricketers, mm-hmm. which before it was named The Cricketers was the Princess of Wales.
Right.
And the deterioration started way back then
right.
in the sort of late 50s, early 60s. And Mrs. Camburn, who was the landlady back then, died. The pub then moved to the local Donald Trump.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was his name was Doug Luff.
Right.
And he had the post office. He had a share in the local garage. He was buying up everything. And the Cricketers
King of
was
Clavering.
One. Yes, absolutely. Doug Luff and his Jaguar and his cravat and pink shirt and sort of smell of Brill Cream
yep.
all slick back and yeah. Everything. Prince of Wales check trousers, you know.
Perfect.
The sort of character. He lost a fortune on it, much to the schadenfreude delight of, yeah. of many people.
Yeah.
He got shot of it, and I believe the next landlords were the Olivers.
Right.
Trevor and Sally,
yeah.
Jamie's mum and dad.
Yeah.
Jamie and his sister Tamsin
yeah.
Moved in there with, as I say, sideways glances and mutterings under the breath
yeah.
as to how long they'd last.
It'll
before.
Never work.
Yes, exactly. And the rest, as they say, is .. Apparently
yeah.
you can't get a table there for about 3 or 4 months. You have to book.
Amazing.
Up in advance, which is fantastic. And Jamie obviously honed his skills back then, you know,
yeah.
helping out his mum and dad,
yeah.
just as I honed my skills in delivering groceries
yeah.
and newspapers. I was certainly doing that from a very early age because my parents had the one of the local village shops,
yeah.
Doug Luff, of course,
yeah.
Being the big operator,
right?
You know, 200 or 300 yards up the road. But Clavering is a weird village.
Yeah.
It's sort of made up of hamlets. It's really so.
Right.
There's an awful lot of distance to cover
yeah.
In the, as it were, parish
yeah.
boundaries that
yeah.
is Clavering.
Yeah.
So there was room for for all.
A nightmare run for a paper boy, I'd imagine.
Indeed.
Big gaps between when you actually get to deliver papers.
Yes, round one. Which was the toughest in terms of distance covered. I mean,
yeah.
you really did do a good 3 or 4 miles a day.
Wow. Yeah.
Covering that
yeah.
As a paper boy.
Yeah.
But, that was essentially it, you know, my, again, a bit like a pub, in effect, and certainly within a village community, you are at the hub of things,
yeah,
really,
yeah,
because
of course.
Virtually everybody in the village at some point steps into your front room, so to speak.
Yeah.
The front room, in my case, being the shop.
Yeah.
It was one of those, you know, it was attached to the house and
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
So it kind of threw the usual dynamic into the complete opposite.
Yeah.
I can remember from a very early age thinking, why is it I seem to be, along with my sister, of course, the only people whose parents never leave?
Right.
Because everybody else is. Well, it was more dads because back in the 50s, you know, it was
yeah.
a lot more traditional then. And
yeah.
for the most part, women stayed at home. And
the dads would go off and work.
And the dads would go
outside
out
of
to
town,
work
yeah.
and come back and have their dinner on the table
mm-hmm.
at the same time every night, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah.
But our life wasn't like that because the work was indeed part of the home. And
So did that mean you were very much, a lot of your upbringing was very much rooted within Clavering? It feels like, particularly in those villages, it's not the kind of place where you venture out particularly early on. It's very much this is the world. And it's weird because it's that feels somewhat restrictive, yet in this day and age I'd imagine you would talking to more people on a daily basis than most people do now, because of the way our towns and villages have become, that there's absolutely not that community and interaction. Absolutely. It may have been a small world that you were living in, but at least you knew everyone, essentially.
Exactly. It was a world that
where everybody knows your name as such.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. But I did, again, buck the trend within all that you've just said there, Pip, because the form was that you went to the local primary school, which was in fact divided into two schools. The lower school, just behind the parish church, you attended until you were 7 or 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went, in effect, through the graveyard, up Middle Street, and went to top school, as it was known. And from there, you went via the 11 plus, either to the local, as it was back then, secondary modern, mm-hmm. which was in Saffron Walden, and a few, very few, boys who passed their 11 plus would go to Newport Grammar.
Right.
And that was essentially the educational route.
Yeah, yeah.
I was, when I was 5,
mm-hmm.
When I started at lower school, Clavering County Primary.
Before you had to cross the graveyard.
Before I had to cross, face
adulthood as...
Indeed. Well, I got my first taste of certainly received adulthood within the educational system by being caught smoking in the toilets.
Okay.
At age 5.
At age 5, right, yes. that's unusual.
That I have yet to meet anybody that started smoking earlier, that's for sure.
Yeah,
and
in fact,
I've yet to meet anybody who had their first drag on a cigarette at that early age. But the problem was that the toilets were open air. Or at least the urinals were.
Mm-hmm.
And the other toilets were chemical. It was all LSAN. There was no mains drainage or anything like that. And so the stalls were kind of a bit open as well.
Yeah.
And me and two other boys, both older, were puffing away in the morning break, and one of the other boys saw all the smoke issuing from the toilet area and informed the headmaster, thinking that the toilets had caught fire. So this is indeed how we were caught. But I don't know whether it had anything to do with the fact that my parents were, as it were, known within the village by virtue of the shop. But
did you get the cigarettes from the shop?
I did. I stole them.
See, that's the logical route. I can see why the older boys would be luring in the young lad, because he's got the access to...
Absolutely.
It's clever. It makes sense. Logic.
the memories are a little bit hazy as to the build-up to all of that, but I've got an awful feeling it was entirely my idea.
No one lured in. I've got these.
And I nicked 10 gold leaf and a box of Swan Vestas off the tobacco shelf in the shop. I certainly got double bubble in terms of punishment for such. My father let me off. Well, he didn't exactly let me off, but I was expecting a beating from him.
Mm-hmm.
But because I owned up immediately as to the fact that I'd stolen the cigarettes and matches, I will never forget it, that he did actually commend me for my honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might have saved me
from
a beating. But however, I wasn't allowed television for 3 weeks.
Right.
And this was kind of the equivalent of everything technological that we have here today.
Yeah.
It would be, a child having his iPad confiscated.
Yeah, everything taken away.
You know, and
even more so in a small village.
And because there wasn't 24/7 telly either.
Yeah.
It was strictly limited. I think it was only about 5 hours a day.
Yeah.
Two of which I was allowed to see before it was bedtime. So it was a massive, massive punishment. But it didn't end there. I experienced my first taste of the cane,
right?
Because the headmaster caned me,
mm-hmm.
And it was me and me alone. The other two boys were let off with a warning, I believe,
right?
But I was the one considered to be the ringleader of the whole experience, and therefore it was me who was caned.
You took the punishment.
It was some six across the hands. I can remember it wasn't too bad when you got them across the palm of your hand,
mm-hmm.
but whether he did it deliberately or accidentally, and it wouldn't at all surprise me if it wasn't the former, he caught me across the knuckle joints of my fingers. And that hurt. In fact, thinking about it, I can feel the pain right now.
Yeah.
Because he had an awkward door catch on his office. It was a sort of brass inlaid handle, which was kind of like a semicircular device that you had to pull out before you could twist it in order to open the door. And I can remember, again to this day, refusing to cry. But the pain was so intense trying to actually get myself out of the office.
It
took both hands to actually open the door and get out. So that was essentially the shape of things to come educationally.
Yeah, yeah.
My father removed me from Clavering when I was 7, but not before I got my first taste of what essentially has become my life, which was playing Mr. Brown in a production of Paddington Bear.
Wow.
At Clavering, at the Village Hall, as a matter of fact, was where the production went on. And a boy called Graham Leach, who was playing Paddington, forgot his lines.
Right.
And it was the curtain line.
Yeah.
And according to Mrs. Driver, the drama or producer of this epic, I managed to improvise our way off stage by burbling on about not being able to hang around for you to say anything because we've got a train to catch. Come on. And off we went, and Mrs. Driver was able to bring the curtain down.
Amazing.
And she apparently remarked on this to my mother when she came into the shop for her whatever it was she needed, saying that it did seem to be an extraordinary feat of presence of mind to be able to improvise at such a young age.
Amazing.
And save the show.
And the kind of thing that you wouldn't know it was a skill that you had until you're tested upon.
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
You could have frozen in that moment. Yeah. You could have stepped up and taken the reins. And
yes, indeed. Well, I knew that something had to happen. I essentially knew everybody's lines. That's how appallingly precocious I must have been back then, you know. But I knew something had to be done. Because otherwise the show couldn't continue, and the show has to continue.
Yeah.
So that was it. So then
it had to end so you could go and finish your fag off out the back. the motivation.
Exactly, yes.
The motivation is strong.
Yes, I need the end of Act One cigarette.
Yeah.
But the problem seemed to be really that I was spent all of my time apparently playing the fool, but was remarkably quick at the basics in education. I could read, write, add up, take away, subtract, divide relatively quickly and very easily. Anything beyond that, latterly, was a massive problem. But my father thought, this is ridiculous. He's in the top two or three every single term, and he's just playing the bloody fool. So he sent me to a junior school in Saffron Walden, the local town, which at the age of seven essentially meant that I was single-sex educated right up until, well, essentially being expelled, as indeed happened.
And what was your journey to school at that age? Was it buses to get there?
By virtue of the fact that the life of a newsagent certainly back then started at a very early hour of the day, it essentially meant that papers were delivered to the paper boys, and all of that was taken care of before about 7 o'clock in the morning. So one breakfast, and then I was driven to Newport, which is about 3 or 4 miles away, and then got the local bus from Newport to Saffron Walden, and the same again at the end of the day, where I was met at Newport and brought home. And the big winter of 63 was talk about the rock and the hard place. Because we managed to get me to Newport, as I say, 3 or 4 miles away from Clavering, and the blizzards were so thick that no buses were running. It was just bleak. And so I thought, well, what do? I've got a 4 mile walk back to Newport, because there were no phones or anything like that. I couldn't phone anybody. Or I've got a 4 mile walk to school. And for some extraordinary reason, I opted to walk to school. Arrived there a little late, shall we say.
Imagine.
Soaking from head to foot, because there was another snowstorm en route. I had disappeared almost up to my chin in a couple of snowdrifts because there were ditches that obviously I didn't know. I was trying to keep off the road. There were no footpaths or anything. So was stood up in front of everybody to as a glorious example of dedication, determination, and a willingness to learn. That was that until I set an entrance exam for a boarding school in Canterbury, Kent College is the name of the school, and I passed that exam. And spent the rest of, pretty much the rest of my educational career at boarding school in Canterbury.
And was that somewhere you focused on acting and on performance, or what was the that stage?
By happenstance, it wasn't in any way part of the curriculum there, but there was a very strong element of drama in the form of house plays, the school play, and the biology master, or one of the biology masters there, was also a brilliant actor and director. And we had a modern English master who wrote a play especially for us along St. Mundy, which centered on the Industrial Revolution and strike breakers and agents provocateurs and all of that area of social history. Along St. Mundy, it was called.
What a great way to learn as well, though, to be making it a game, essentially. Education, rather than here's a story. Let's make that story. Let's create that story.
Absolutely. It was definitely, I've always wanted to be an actor. I mean, pretty much since my debut as Mr. Brown in Paddington Bear. I just got the, people call it a vocation. I tend to refer to it more as a virus, really. A bit like herpes. The minute you think you got rid of it, it comes back in all manner of areas that you didn't think existed.
It's kind of interesting how little it can take, and it feels like, at that age, being told by a teacher that you'd done good naturally and that you were naturally good at this is enough often to give you that urge to run in that direction. If that moment, essentially, if that other boy hadn't forgotten his lines, it may never have gone in the direction it went. Do you know what I mean? It could have just been another thing you did because that's what you did at school, but because you had to improvise in that moment and got that praise. Yes. And again, and not to speak like it's a different world, but particularly in those times, praise wasn't at the forefront of education.
No, no.
And of upbringing in general. It was very much people getting on with what they do. So to have that was probably a real exciting thing to make you go, all right, I'm an adult is telling me I'm good at something. Well, I want that to happen again.
There you go. More often. I really seriously hoped it would happen while I was away at school.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was a terrible, terrible moment when rumour had it that Mr. Carter, the biology master who directed the plays, wasn't going to do it anymore.
All right.
And essentially my world fell apart to such an extent that he happened to also be what they called the house tutor, which was the second master within the every boarding house had a house master, and then there would be another master, usually, well, in fact, always unmarried, as Mr. Carter was at that time. And I knocked on his study door in desperation. To find out if there was any truth in this rumour, which took him aback somewhat, because it was something that you didn't actually do. You were summoned.
Yeah.
You didn't just knock on people's doors
and question. Yeah.
Exactly. So once he got over that and sort of didn't give me a clear answer as to whether it was true or not, I kind of confessed to him that actually what I wanted to do with my life was to become a professional actor. Mm-hmm. And he immediately dissuaded me from it.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, when he said, I wouldn't recommend you do that at all, were his words. And I immediately thought, because, well, I'm obviously not good enough, and he would know. But then he went on to quantify what he just said by saying that it was a profession riddled with alcoholics, homosexuals, and drug addicts. And I thought, that's 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
When can I start?
Yeah.
But it was a few years later before... I eventually made it to drama school by, again, certainly to this point in time, a unique path.
Right, yeah.
That I haven't really heard anybody, in a sense, come close to.
Okay. Go on.
Well, my time at boarding school terminated, unbeknownst to me. I was just informed by my father after the first year in the sixth form, the A-level stage of educational life, having spectacularly underperformed at O-level, that he wasn't going to waste any more money, in effect. He'd come to a mutual agreement with the headmaster that I wasn't to return the following term.
Okay.
And as far as he, my father, was concerned, I could do what the hell I wanted, because he'd had enough of these continual failures on my part. I essentially begged him to give me a second chance. And that's when I went to the local comprehensive school, as it was by this time. This would be 1970-71, and the whole secondary modern grammar school divide was under serious breakup.
Right.
I do recall that it was round about the onset of what is now known as the comprehensive education system that pretty much still exists to this day.
Yeah.
However, I only lasted there about a term and a half.
Right.
And this was due to just before I left Kent College. This would be at the time of, you know, the late 60s. Easy Rider was the big movie of the time.
Yeah.
And along with that, you know, the whole hippie movement, the Vietnam War protests, all of that peace, love. Turn on and drop out. Timothy Leary, all of that stuff. And I was a little curious as to what that world was all about. Yeah. So I discovered cannabis when I was about 16, as a matter of fact. And, you know, finances permitting, you used to have the quid deal is what it was.
Amazing.
Like. You know, you had a pound and you got a few smokes for a quid. Brilliant. That's for sure.
That's good value.
Indeed. And anyway, I carried this on and within, I think, about a week of starting at the Comprehensive in Saffron Walden, there were a couple of other outsiders, as it were, who just started in the same year, the sixth form, and they had connections. And there was a cafe that all the subculture revolved around.
Yeah.
And anyway, it was one day when I was late for the school bus. The school itself ran a bus service for all the villages surrounding Saffron Walden. Mm-hmm. And as I ran up to Blacksmith's Corner to catch the bus to school that morning, it was actually a run in the opposite direction to the school. So as I passed the shop on the bus heading towards school, my stomach and everything else did a 360, 180 Wurlitzer roller coaster lurch as I realized that I'd left this little pouch with, I think, I can tell you exactly, 4.28 grams of cannabis resin right beside my bed. And
wow.
I thought no more of it because having been in an all-boys school since the age of seven, the onset of girls in school was just too much to cope with.
Yeah, yeah. And the minute big distraction.
I saw Leslie Clark was her name, my my first love. As soon as I saw Leslie Clark in class, that was it. That's all I could think about was her. Until I got home that afternoon.
Yeah.
And there were two policemen waiting for me.
Wow.
And to cut a long story short, I did at the time have a Honda 50. I was 17at this time. And the rear light had packed up.
Right.
And what I'd been doing was essentially riding the foot brake, which would just put the brake light on. So I was exactly... Light. That's exactly what I was doing. And I'd hoped that it might have been something to do with that. Until one of the policemen mentioned the Squinting Cat, which was the name of the cafe where all things nefarious happened.
Right.
And I knew exactly what it was about. And they wanted to search my bedroom. I tried to get into to my bedroom first, but one of the policemen beat me to it.
Yeah.
And as soon as he saw which door I was heading for, just jumped in front of me and got in there first.
Right.
And there it was, exactly where I'd left it, right beside my my bed. And he immediately went for a chest of drawers, and once he upended the contents onto the floor, it wasn't the biggest room in the world. I just thought, well, you know, I'd sooner not have the room trashed.
Yeah.
So I just said, I think that's what you're looking for, and pointed out the pouch.
Yeah.
to which they immediately seized upon it and opened it up and sniffed it and, "Are you aware of what this is?" And rather cheekily I said, "Well, I certainly hope so, otherwise I've been ripped off,"
yeah,
haven't I?
Yeah, paid good money for this.
Exactly. And that was it. I was taken to Saffron Walden Police Station, put in a police cell for 2 or 3 hours while they went through the paperwork and said, "We are arresting you for possession of what we believe to be cannabis resin." But the charge couldn't be formal until they'd actually had the substance tested to ascertain that it was indeed, which it was.
Yeah.
And I was then taken to court at a later date. And because I was 17, I was criminally responsible, so there was nothing juvenile that I could cop for. And my ignorance led me to believe that it was either borstal, a fine, or detention centre, and hopefully possibly probation, which I saw as being the easier, softer option, which indeed it is. A supervisionary order contains terms and conditions that you're actually not aware of until you've agreed and been, as it were, sentenced to a period of supervisionary probation. My stretch was 2 years, and the clerk of the court then read out terms and conditions, which essentially it's a bit like parole, really, you know, that if they want you back inside, they'll nick you for littering. So they're all of that, you know, if you don't show up for work, if you don't do homework while you're still at school, if you mess around in class, if you give lip to your boss, if you don't pay your rent, if you cause unnecessary strife within the family household, and this what ultimately I was done for, and that constitutes a breach of the order. And I was then taken back to court, and the order was changed from a supervisionary one to a custodial one. In the interim, the initial hearing, the headmaster of the local comprehensive expelled me in front of the court. And I can understand he didn't want 1,500 parents phoning up wanting to know what the hell was going on in the school. It was a dodgy time, 1970-71. The perceived wisdom was that if you smoked a joint on Monday, you were mainlining heroin by Friday.
And it was such a tough one as well, because it was so close to the time that it was completely accepted, because it was a new drug and unknown, and people like Leary spoke so eloquently and alluringly of these things, and it caused that huge backlash to a war on drugs and numerous pieces of propaganda material that now can be traced to have been funded by tobacco industries and funded by all sorts of other illegal industries to stop this evil demon drug coming through. But yeah, it was very much this dark, scary, horrible thing. Particularly, you've got your motorbike, you probably had your leather jacket, you're straight off of the screen. You're straight off the screen of the rebellious element.
I was just going to say, you know, there was a war on youth back then.
And it's not long from the first time, as crazy as it sounds, the first time youth had a voice and had a movement.
Well, indeed,
with rock and roll and with things like that, as cliche as that sounds, that was the first time youth weren't kind of just seen and not heard and so on and so forth.
Indeed.
It was the first time it was, we've got our own voice and our own thing.
Exactly,
so that was
a
scary element,
exactly,
I guess.
Exactly. Well, the biggest sort of misnomer, really, or misperception of the 60s was that Sergeant Pepper's et al. Was a minority. The rest of the 60s, the other 90% of it, if you will, was rock-solid post-war establishment, which was brought up on seen and not heard, do as you're told, do not question, do not argue, do as I say, not as I do. All of that, and it really did frighten the establishment hugely. They really thought that the society is going to fall apart.
It's all going to come crumbling down around.
Indeed. Them, yeah. So stamp on it. Make an example of everybody who is caught on the wrong side of the line, so to speak. And in effect, you know, timing is all, as the great man said, and that is pretty much how I live my life.
Yeah.
You know, I don't believe in coincidence, but I certainly do believe in timing.
Yeah.
And this was just bad timing, really.
Right, yeah, of course.
The problem with being expelled from the school there and then, forthwith and not a second later, was that I was playing the lead in the school play at the time. Well, the compromise was that I was allowed to rehearse and perform the play, but on no account was I to attend lessons.
That's
well, it broke my heart.
That's like best of both worlds, right?
Exactly.
What is this punishment you speak of?
Exactly. I rocked up to school on my Honda 50 in time for rehearsals and saw them all sat there with collars open and jackets on backs of chairs, sweating and fretting over Molière or whatever else was on the syllabus at the time, and thinking, you know, boy, I wish I was with you. It breaks my heart that I'm not in there with you. Hey ho, that's how it goes.
It blew my mind at school, even that suspension was a step above detention.
Yeah,
the punishment of being kept there longer is surely far worse than the punishment of not having to go in at all. Even though it's frowned upon and you're damned, you're still not having to go in anymore, which at that point you don't want to do.
Well, at boarding school, I copped a week suspension for repeatedly being caught smoking, I think, about eight times in 2 days or something.
Yeah.
And I just remember sitting in the local flea pit in Bishop Snortford, actually. Clavering is pretty much exactly between the two towns, eight miles either side. And Women in Love was playing at the Regent. And I can remember there on a Monday afternoon with a packet of Number Six, puffing away, watching Jenny Linden and Alan Bates having a quick knee trembler up against an oak tree, and thinking, this is punishment.
Yeah,
bring it on. However, the probation officer that I had in Saffron Walden came to see me perform in this play at Saffron Walden County High School, as it is known as now. It was the insect play by the brothers Chapek, and I played the tramp, which is essentially, he's never off. The whole play revolves around this character, hence the disaster that would have been if
you're pulled from that.
You know, there would have been no play. It'd be like trying to play Hamlet without Hamlet. It couldn't be done. So anyway, my probation officer saw me in that and was very taken with my performance, so much so that the next time I had to see him, which was Tuesday afternoon at 5 o'clock, that's essentially all he banged on about. He was well impressed. However, come the time when I was reassigned to a custodial order, which involved going from court in Saffron Walden, driven by my probation officer up to Southwood Probation Hostel for Boys in Liverpool. And when we finally arrived, it was about a 10-hour journey. It was a nightmare. He got lost around spaghetti junk. It really was. It a gruesome journey. However, we finally made it. And his last words before, I can only assume, heading all the way back to Essex, there and then, was to say to the warden and matron of the hostel, who were in fact man and wife, I've seen him act and he is very good. Is there any way that this could be encouraged? And it was very much like boarding school, as a matter of fact.
Yeah,
you know, there were strict rules and regulations. We weren't actually locked up, although obviously at night all exits to the real world were locked. But we weren't in cells or anything, even though we had what was known as single rooms, which were pretty much, I mean, they were just like tiny little bedrooms, really, with reinforced glass and, you know, a little, and only small windows. But I was in one of them when I should really have been in a dormitory. But for some reason, I ended up in a single room, which caused a bit of problems because they were a privileged item.
Of course,
you know, if you behaved yourself, then that's what your first...
So entering with the first impression of you getting some kind of privilege or wherever it's not.
Exactly. And, you know, I was a first offender or first-time offender. Mm-hmm. All the other lads are about another 20 or so in the hostel had all got a lot of previous, a lot of previous.
Yeah.
And had really been right through the gamut from short-term DC, 3 months, 6 months, long-term. And that's all you can get. It's the short, sharp shock side of it all. Borstal, some have been YPs, young prisoners in strange ways. Walton, you know, they'd all done an awful lot, and mainly twockers, breaking an entry, taking without owner's consent, carnicking. There were a couple of GBHs, a couple of ABHs, but nobody had been in there for drugs.
I was going to say, it's different from smoking a bit of weed.
Oh, absolutely. Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed. But what saved me was the fact that I was funny. I have quite a talent for impersonation, so I could do impressions of the staff, you know.
Perfect.
And I learnt from a very early age that if people are laughing at you, then they're not going to hit you. That saved me from probably an awful lot of beatings.
Yeah, that's great.
But ultimately, it was no different from school.
You know,
I certainly didn't suffer the trauma of being separated from the family home or anything like that. That happened years previously. It was pretty much, instead of double Latin, you got double toilet cleaning. You also went out to work, you know, and I got a job as a hospital porter.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, I think it wasn't a bad system, really, because your wage packet had to be returned, with yourself, of course, to the warden, unopened. Which actually posed a bit of a problem when I received my first pay packet at Mosley Hill Hospital in Liverpool, is where I was portering, because you had to open the packet in front of the pay clerk to make double certain that you had the right money.
You know,
he'd take out your wage slip and check the net amount against what was actually, you know, it's a little brown envelope with a window in it, you know, those type of things.
Yeah.
And I was in a terrible state because I thought, oh, no, I'm going to be in trouble now because I've opened the my pay packet. Anyway, I wasn't because they realised that, you know, I had no choice in the matter. So they weren't sadistic in that sense, you know. There was an element of fairness in all of that.
But it's interesting because it feels like accommodation wise and whatnot, as you kind of say, if you'd simply changed schools, it would have just felt like, oh, this is just a different school, if you know what I mean. Like, this isn't quite as nice, but or particularly that one, oh, this must be what the schools are like up north.
Yes.
Kind of, rather than the fact is it was actually a punishment and all this kind of thing. But if you'd not known otherwise, it wouldn't have been, it doesn't feel as if it would have been that much of a,
no.
Look where I am.
No. Yeah. You were forced to clean the place morning and at night before you went to work and when you came back.
Yeah.
And given that nobody was there all day, you know, it wasn't, you know, an you know, an arduous task. Yeah, it was just something you had to do. And that presumably was, you know, to instill a bit of discipline in your character. £5 out of your wage packet was sent straight to the Home Office, which I guess puts you in the mindset of realizing that what you earn isn't all yours. Mm-hmm. You've got to pay for stuff. Most especially your accommodation.
I've never let you forget that, have they?
No. You got 20 pence a day for your lunch.
Right.
And £1 for the weekend.
Wow.
And you were allowed out certain times, but only so far. Essentially, St George's Hall was the border in the centre of Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And if you crossed over into Lime Street and were seen, then you were straight back to court. That was the thing.
Right,
you were essentially in a halfway house type situation.
Yeah, that's fascinating that there's restrictionary borders.
Very much.
You've got that freedom, but it's literally you can't cross the line.
Yes, and then you really are in trouble. No mercy ensues.
Yeah.
Not a lot, but several.
Yeah,
boys, because you're allowed out, you see, during the day,
and that temptation is indeed,
and a few of them succumbed, you know, and tried to abscond. They were
Part of it, isn't it, to put that temptation
Absolutely.
There and teach you to not choose it, rather than not give you the option.
Indeed,
it's a better lesson to say what
here
you
it
want
is
here.
Yes.
You can't have it.
Yeah.
You know, that's going to teach you more, I guess.
Well, do you know, that's a brilliant point, Pip, because you've just reminded me. Because when it came to allowing me to go out when every other boy couldn't to attend rehearsals, I ended up joining. They gave me, I think it was about 3 or 4 days after I'd arrived, a flyer. For a company called Merseyside Unity Theatre, which, as it turned out, was a tip-top Am-Dram company.
Yeah.
And there was a little handwritten note on this flyer informing me that there was a small part in the current production of Events While Guarding the Bofors Gun by John McGrath.
Okay.
Part of a German soldier, he appears right at the beginning of the play. The main cast take the mickey out of him, and he's gone by about page 4, I think.
Yeah,
you know, half a dozen lines, and that was it. Well, when I got permission to attend, because they could only rehearse in the evenings twice during the week,
right? Yeah,
midweek rehearsals, which was contravened, you know, the rules of and regulations of the hostel. However, I was given permission on the understanding, and this comes back to the point you raised there, Pip, that I did not abuse the trust that I was given.
Yeah.
Because like any company, whether it's drama or a choir or whatever, you know, the usual form is that once you've finished, several, if not all, retire to the local pub, you know, have a couple of drinks and then go their way. Well, A, I couldn't stay to the end of rehearsal, so that precluded any of that.
Mm-hmm.
But temptation was always there. Liverpool's full of bars, you know.
Yeah.
But I never once did I abuse the trust that I was granted, because I valued the theatre far more than, you know, sticking two fingers up at authority.
Yeah.
So I played the game in that respect.
It's fascinating here, because there's a continued theme of honest rebellion from the age of 5, of smoking but getting caught and owning up to it, and from, even if it was said in a sarcastic or frivolous way, the addressing of what you've got to the police when they're searching your room, the going to school when there was all the snow, all these things of making those choices. It was I had Howard Marks on the podcast just before he passed away.
Did you really?
And it was amazing to chat to him. And it was fascinating to realise he's one of the most known criminals in the land.
Yes.
Yet he only ever broke laws he didn't agree with, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And one of the things that we discussed, and a story I told to kind of get across the strangeness of having laws that we don't agree with, but obeying them blindly, is a relative of mine at the age of over 50, went to Amsterdam and for the first time tried weed. Had never tried it before, and it struck me. And they asked me for advice because they knew that I'd done my fair share in my days. Like I helped them out with the right thing to get, and it fascinated me that if I went somewhere that murder was legal, I wouldn't go, oh, I'll give murder a try.
Yes.
It's bizarre that we have these laws that if we go to another place and they're allowed, we would potentially do them. So why do we accept that and obey that as a law? And it just strikes me that all of the issues that you'd had of rebellion in your youth, and again, it's in the context of era and of time, of those things wouldn't be stamped upon as much now, wouldn't be seen as much of a rebellion in this day and age as such. But they're all ones where you've known what you're doing is wrong, but you've only been doing it to yourself.
Yes.
You're smoking a cigarette, you're smoking the weed, you're not
absolutely
engaging in any acts against anyone else. And then when caught, you've been quite,
absolutely,
hands up to it. So it's kind of, it makes sense that then when put in that situation where you have the choice to break the rules but repeatedly choose not to, that makes perfect sense to me, because it's in keeping with the type of rebellion you've been punished for.
Absolutely. Well, there's a sort of moral code in there somewhere, you
completely,
know.
Completely.
I have such a horrifically guilty conscience and always have done, I think. Yeah. That it's the lesser of the two pains, really.
Yeah.
Because the pain of deceit is infinitely greater than the pain of owning up to something, knowing full well what the punishment's going to be.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's essentially how I live or try to live my life.
Yeah.
And another sort of perverse twist just on that sort of note is while I, like everybody else, hates paying tax, I always get a feeling of freedom when I have indeed met the demand in full, written the check or backed the amount it is now. And while it's always a huge hole that's left, what always makes me feel better is the fact that I've done it. And I see that as allowing me to say what I like, do what I like, within reason, of course, because I've paid my dues.
You've paid for the right to
absolutely
do so. Perfect.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
Man, I told you, that guy has got the most amazing stories. Imagine how lucky I am. I'm working on this amazing film, and when I'm not filming, I'm getting to talk to these, I'm getting to hear stories off Chris, off Neil, off Stevie, off everyone. It's amazing. And honestly, everyone on this set, I'm going to try not to immediately, but I want to do a podcast with literally everybody. Adam Fogarty's amazing. Jill Halfpenny is absolutely amazing. And they're just, amazing people. So there will be more to come, but I'll hold off for a bit, hopefully. I'm going to keep this outro short because there's another one coming up at midday. So check that out. I'll see you in a bit. Bye-bye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. only from Rust-Oleum.